Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Papua New Guinea's police commissioner says provincial and divisional police commanders will have support from HQ in managing potential hotspots during the elections. Gary Backe has called on all division commanders for a meeting this week in Port Moresby for planning towards PNG's upcoming general elections in late June. Commissioner Backe says the policing of these elections in each province will be managed by provincial and divisional commanders rather than from Moresby. He spoke to Johnny Blades, who asked him about a military and police call-out to troubled Highland province Hela, where police recently wrapped up a guns amnesty period.
Yes, it's difficult. When we did the winding down of the actual amnesty period in about a week ago, our local population had been told directly that we know that there are still some weapons that have not been surrendered during the period of amnesty, and that they're still been still requested to surrender those weapons despite the fact that the amnesty has been expired, because the phase two of the operations, which is actually commencing now, and that is going to be targeted operations, meaning that based on the available information and intelligence to us, we will go directly and hit those people that we believe that have firearms and have not surrendered them during the period of amnesty.
Will you maintain a bit of an increased deployment up there through until the general elections?
Yes, we will maintain presence there leading up into the elections. Not the current number, but on a reduced size over there, but the enforcement will be still the same until we get into the elections.
So with the elections, I think there's going to be about, 10,000 police deployed across the country?
Yes, actually 9,600 police personnel will be deployed, including 1,000 personnel from the 500 from the defence and another 500 from the correctional service that will assist police. We'll be having a final brief with all the divisional commanders on Thursday. I will be having that, and that's to see where they are in terms of their planning. I've just finished a meeting with our people in headquarters, and the next thing now is to source the funding from Treasury to support our personnel on the ground. Election operations is going to be totally different, because I've given the responsibility back to the divisional commanders to run in the divisions rather than being dictated from police headquarters.
That's right. So that's different from previous elections. The provincial police heads will be in charge in those provinces rather than HQ in the capital, right?
Yes.
Do you think that's going to work out? I mean, obviously, when the ballot boxes, there's a lot of worries about how they might be manipulated. I suppose the police will be crucial, won't they, in securing the ballots?
Well, it's really not an issue about having one policeman or 10 policemen or 5 policemen to every polling booth. We are there to provide the environment. The people need to also assist the police and the security personnel in terms of the elections. The entire election security basically attributes also to the way that people behave. So where there is an issue of breach of the processes, then we step in. If there is no breach, we allow it to go. But when there are issues that beyond the control of the Electoral Commission, then we will have to decide what is the best approach to deal with the situation. It's going to be challenging. But the issue is we are not leaving our divisional and provincial police commands alone. There will be a response unit posted to hotspots where we consider likely issues of trouble to occur. So they will have supportive personnel deployed from headquarters to support them.
The president of Bougainville hopes the latest memorandum of understanding signed with the PNG national government will lead to improved financing for the autonomous region. The MOU is concerned the hands down of powers from the national government to the autonomous Bougainville government. This aims to devolve more powers in areas such as education, agriculture, health, tourism, and conservation. Bougainville President John Momus told Don Wiseman it is a welcome development, but says it'll depend on whether the national government meets its constitutional commitments for the financial support.
Well, it's a development that has come after a long wait. National government has been dragging its feet, but it's been slow. As you know, the powers that we've asked to be drawn down are powers that were negotiated a long time ago when the peace agreement was signed. So the powers do belong to us, and it's time that they are given to us. I guess the only excuse the national government might have is lack of capacity, and lack of capacity here directly due to the lack of funding, which the national government fails to give to us as per the peace agreement. So yes, it's a welcome event decision by the national government to sign this overarching MOU.
Does it mean, though, that there's a greater commitment by Port Moresby to get the funding to you that you've been looking for?
Well, you know, we've had a lot of signing of MOUs, you know, that have been ignored. You know, signing an MOU doesn't mean funding will come. We've been subjected to this for a long, long time, you know. So I hope, you know, this signals a greater commitment by the national government to send funding, but we'll wait and see.
I was speaking with officials in the ABG back at the beginning of February, just after a major earthquake had a significant impact down south of the main island, and the local disaster authority was not able to do anything about it because it didn't have any money. In fact, it was in significant debt. And this came back to this lack of funding coming through from Port Moresby. Is that situation remedied?
I've just come back from the Philippines, so I'm not sure, but I suspect the situation has not been remedied. I suspect nothing has been done, because that has been the story. Funds committed under the peace agreement have never been dispersed to us. So the situation is not conducive to just negotiations between the national government and the Bougainville government, because under the peace agreement, which is a joint creation, the two parties must adhere to the peace agreement. When powers are transferred, commensurate funding should also be transferred.
You, on a number of occasions, have said that you would take legal action over this lack of movement from Port Moresby over the financing. Have you got any closer to doing that, or is that really, in the end, an empty threat?
We have engaged a constitutional lawyer, and when funds are available, we will proceed with the court case, which will be a constitutional interpretation of the laws, that's all. We firmly believe the national government has contravened its own constitution. The Bougainville Peace Agreement is enshrined in the Papua New Guinea Constitution. In other words, the national government is bound constitutionally to give us the funds which are required for autonomy building, to prepare for the referendum, to deliver services in Bougainville.
The problem for Port Moresby, of course, is right across the board, they're having to cut back on their spending because there's just not the money.
That's right, I guess so. But even when the money was available, well, this problem has started even in 2005 when Port Moresby was spending money on all kinds of projects. Bougainville wasn't getting its share of the money. We're not begging the national government. This is money stipulated in the Constitution for Bougainville. It's our constitutional entitlement.
Amnesty International says a barrier installed at Manus Island Detention Center in Papua New Guinea could be something that would lead to torture if it is making it difficult for detainees to access food. This follows a report of a brawl breaking out between two inmates and guards at the detention center last Saturday when a dispute over food turned violent. A Kurdish journalist and detainee, Basrav Bokani, has said the brawl has sparked a new barrier erected to manage the line of detainees queuing for their meals. He alleges the guards put up the barrier because they believe some detainees were taking more food than they should. Amelia Langford spoke to Amnesty's Pacific researcher, Kate Schultz.
The way the centre is operated, it's designed to be deliberately cruel and take away the dignity of people there. And so the latest reports are that a barrier was erected around the food queue, making it very difficult for people to access food. And the rationale the guards are giving, of course, are they saying that asylum seekers are taking too much food. But of course, if they're detaining them there, they have the obligation to provide adequate food. So we have this sort of downward spiral in terms of trying to create cruel and harsher conditions in order to pressure those people to return home. So I think both these issues are linked together.
So you would say this is a deliberate act to make it even more unpleasant to be there?
Exactly. And so, I mean, the things we were hearing when we visited in 2013 and 2014, that a simple request for shade as people were queuing up outside for lunch for hours in direct sunlight was being refused, you know, and there was no rational basis for doing this other than to increase the pressure, increase the cruelty that those people are experiencing. And it's designed to make the experience as uncomfortable as possible and force them to return home.
And would you be calling for that barrier to be removed?
Yeah, I mean, look, what we're seeing is a range of small measures that increase the cruelty in the meantime for those living on Manus. And you know, there's specific acts or steps that we've called on the Australian government to do in the past to try and ease the pressure on those people living there, and ridiculous things such as creating barriers and making it more difficult for people to access food in and of itself could amount to a violation on the prohibition against torture if, in fact, it is denying people access to meals.
And the pressure is increasing for these detainees to return home.
Well, I mean, the risk is if there is undue pressure for these people to return home, that they may decide that rather than suffering on an island thousands of miles away from their family, that they would prefer to go back to their families and die. And some people express that concern to us when we've interviewed them, which is quite alarming because that means that the Australian government would be breaching its obligations not to refoul people, which means sending them back to a place where they might experience torture, death or other serious harm because they're being sent to a place, you know, that they were fleeing in the first place. So the risk of that situation arising increases as that pressure builds and as more people might be returning home.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Seven vessels have been caught for illegally fishing in a 10-day Pacific surveillance operation, which ended last Friday. Nine Pacific countries ran Operation Ran Banglang in 2017, which was coordinated by the Foreign Fisheries Agency Surveillance Center in Solomon Islands. The operation covered an area of 14.7 million square kilometers and detected nearly 1,000 fishing vessels. The team of the FFA's Regional Fisheries Surveillance Center, Commander Gavin Backer, spoke to Corey Hawkins about the operation, beginning with the vessels who were found breaking the rules.
So during the operation, we had two significant apprehensions where vessels were brought into port by the apprehending vessels. That was a fishing vessel in the FSM EEZ that was brought into Ponape by the FSM patrol boat Micronesia, and another vessel that was brought in by the RSIPF patrol vessel Auki into Honiara. So those are the two major apprehensions. I haven't received any detail from either organization yet, but generally we would hope that once they've gone through their investigation process and arrived at a determination what action they're going to take, they will keep us informed. And once they come with a final outcome, they would sort of close the loop with us just so that we can sort of maintain a sort of a track on what has happened in you know, each of those major apprehensions. The other two, the other five, were relatively minor marking infringements reported by Tokoro, which is the Vanuatu patrol boat, where vessels were either improperly or poorly marked to indicate their licensing or registration numbers. And there are, you know, very definite requirements about how big the letters have got to be and, you know, that sort of thing.
Right. And this is the second year you've been also looking out for the inshore poachers, the Vietnamese, so-called Vietnamese blue boats, and the first time you've had air surveillance supporting that initiative as well, yeah?
Well, very specifically, yes. The blue boat issue has been something that has sort of been building over the last couple of years, and it's gradually spread from sort of the northwestern Pacific into the broader sort of almost halfway across our area of interest. We've had multiple incursions in about five or six member EEZs, apprehensions in Plough and FSM, as well as the French and Australian apprehensions. And PNG has also been very active. In fact, that was where the most recent activity observed during our operation was, with three separate detections within the PNG EEZ of Vietnamese blue boats. And you're right, this is the first time when we've actually provided specific tasking to the aircraft as part of their mission was, while their mission was already always primarily against IUU fishing in the oceanic tuna fishing industry, which is our primary mandate. They were also provided with secondary tasking to keep their eyes open for and report upon any Vietnamese blue boats detected.
Yes. Now, this is the correct me if I'm wrong, the annual operation that's run every year, the around this period. How are you seeing offences over the years coming up to now? Comparing, are there more offences? Are people complying better? Is there any trend you can pick up?
Yeah, this is, as you mentioned, this is one of our annual operations. We run four a year. So Rabalang is the first operation of the year, and it generally starts around about this time, ish, give or take a few weeks because of weather conditions. And then we progress through the year with a series of operations, geographically spread across the entire region. In terms of apprehensions and citations, I think we've seen a gradual decrease, particularly in the last couple of years. When we first started doing this many years ago, well before my time, apprehensions and citations and all those sorts of things were much more prevalent because the fishermen sort of didn't realize that we were starting to take a more active hand. And I think over the last probably 3 to 5 years, it's been brought home to them because of the enforcement activities being conducted across the region, that if they're out there and we're keeping an eye on them, and if we spot something that looks questionable, and we've got a pretty good eye on most of the operations across the region, then there's a reasonable chance that if they're not boarded while they're at sea or one of the troll boats, they'll be questioned the next time they're alongside in an FFA member port offloading catch or revictualling or refueling.
Yes, so quite a positive development then in terms of fishing vessels and their owners are probably seeing that it's probably more smarter and better business sense to just comply rather than to try and go around things.
Exactly right, and that's what we assess the case is. These are pragmatic businessmen, and they recognise that being hammered with a multi tens or hundreds or more thousands of dollars fine is bad for business. So a few dollars up front to pay for the licences and instructions to their skippers and their fishermen to follow the rules. They might see a marginally reduced income because they're following the rules, but in the long term, that is by far balanced by the fact they're not getting done for the fines.
Papua New Guinea's major liquefied natural gas, or LNG, project could be shut down again due to simmering landowner frustrations. Landowners in the Highland province of Hela say the government has let them down again by not following through on promised benefits from the multi-billion dollar gas project. As Johnny Blaze reports, things are at risk of flaring up again in the heart of the ExxonMobil-operated LNG project.
Landowners mounted a protest blockade of the project's gas conditioning plant in Hides last August. In response, the government agreed to address the landowners' grievances over lack of benefits and equity arrangements within 30 days. Hides landowner representative Andy Hamaga says government did not honour its promise.
Unfortunately, today they haven't done anything, and we are looking at options whether to take them to court or go to international arbitration or go back again and start down the whole operation before the general election.
At the time of last year's blockade, in response, the government said the delays in benefit payments to landowners were due to complications over identifying genuine landowners. The Petroleum and Energy Minister, Nixon Duban, said it was in the best interests of Hela to ensure that the right beneficiaries would be getting paid. However, Mr. Hamaga says this is misleading.
The state minister is not giving us the actual information. They are supposed to do this claim vetting and landowner social networking thing before we sign the big umbrella benefit agreement we have signed in 2009. That thing they are using, that one as an excuse.
At the end of last year, 300 extra police and military personnel were deployed to Hela after months of tribal fighting and a build-up of high-powered weapons, with hides central to the unrest. Police wrapped up a weapons amnesty at the end of last month with mixed success. The police commissioner, Gary Barkey, admits high-powered weapons remain in the community in Hela.
Phase two of the operations, which is actually commencing now, and that is going to be targeted operations, meaning that based on the available information and intelligence to us, we will go directly and hit those people that we believe that have firearms and have not surrendered them during the period of amnesty. So I'm aware that there are a couple of incidents that have been happening up in Hela.
A local NGO worker who has mediated between warring tribes, James Komengi, says that while the military call-out meant that large-scale hostilities were scaled back, fresh bursts of fighting are starting up again.
There's a lot of conflict within the communities, and so there have been attempts to murder people. We received reports from across Como, close to the LNG project area, that there have been some men who have armed with high-powered guns and they've attempted to murder tribal enemies, and that's last week. So the attitude of warriors haven't changed.
The police commissioner says his force will maintain a strong presence in Hela through until PNG's elections, with polling commencing in late June. However, Gary Barkey indicates police will not get involved should the Hides landowners launch another blockade, saying it's a matter between the government, the developer and the landowners. This is Johnny Blades.
Kava growers in Vanuatu are working hard to produce more notable varieties of kava for the fast-growing market in America. The notable variety of kava has a sedative effect with no hangover the next day and is more desirable overseas than some other varieties. John Fordham, the founder of the export kava company, Forner Enterprises, says more than 100 kava bars have been established in the United States. That's Canada and the U.S., of course. In the last 10 years, he spoke to Indira Stewart about the growing kava market in America and the challenges faced by local suppliers to meet demand.
At the moment, there's around about 100 kava bars in America and numerous online sellers. So I think 2008, we set up the first kava bar there called Nakamal at Home. That was the first Nakamal. I think that's 2008. And since then, it's expanded to 100 kava bars.
And whereabouts are those kava bars? Are they in certain parts of America or generally all over?
No, generally all over. There's a few states that don't have them, mainly because of the health regulations and stuff. But a lot of the states have got them. There's a bit of a concentration in Florida, more so than any other states. There's a few in New York, here in California.
And who are the main consumers buying kava from America? Are they generally Pacific Islanders or other people?
No. The kava bars I've been in America, you'd count the number of Pacific people on one hand. It's that's just a general run of the mill people, varying ages, from anywhere from sort of 18, 19 up to, 40, 45. Some people are very interested in where it comes from and how it's grown and things like that, and they're really keen to find information from you. But a lot of them just understand it to be a South Pacific drink. And just enjoy the effect, the relaxation after work. But a lot of the kava bars over there are open nearly all day, right through the lunch hour. Whereas in the Pacific, it's generally around about 5 o'clock, the kava bars are open.
Wow, and so that market has been growing slowly over the years since your first kava bar established there in 2008. Do you anticipate that it will get even bigger?
Yes, it'll grow. It's sort of a rising curve. It's been a slow start. It took about 6 years to get to 50 and a couple of years to get to 100. The problem now is, of course, is supply of noble variety. Can we supply the market with noble variety? So that's the question. Nobody really knows how much carver's out there in the islands. You think a lot of the carver's been pulled, and all of a sudden you'll get this carver that's 15, 20 years old. But it just depends on where you are. How old the kava is as to the quality.
The effects of climate change, does that have an impact on kava?
Oh, definitely. Before in Vanuatu, we were getting a storm each day, and in most places, it was a really green place. But over the years, now you're seeing grass fires, long periods without rain, and that really affects the kava. And it also reduces the areas where you can grow kava. like in the hills in Pentecost, Malekula, you know, it's always raining there. It's got a good fall, but in the lower flats, that's where the changes are being felt. You know, you can lose thousands of plants in a dry spell. The supply cover certainly has reduced. We've had these dry seasons, and we've also had Cyclone Pam, which wiped out a huge amount of cover, broke off all the stems, and the farmers just couldn't harvest it in time and couldn't sell it in time, and they lost a lot of the older plants. But there are still areas. There's lots of areas in Vanuatu where you can grow carver and still have a good rainfall. It's just, I think, the areas have reduced that are reliable for you to grow the carver.
If in Vanuatu you can't meet the supply for a growing demand in overseas exports like places like America, will you look at sourcing from other places in the Pacific?
No, I think we've got to concentrate. We have got the areas to grow the carver. We've got the people to grow it. We've got the incentive now with the increased prices. And it's the first year that the government, that I've noticed that there's been a real genuine effort to encourage the farmers to get out there and plant more carver, plant a noble variety. And it's been a real push. So that's very encouraging for people like me who process and export. They have awareness programs on what to plant and how you should be planting it. So it's a bit of a change environment for the growers. They're more aware of what the market needs. We had a meeting at in Luganville a few weeks ago, and there must probably be 300 to 400 people turned up. I've never seen a meeting that big before. And as far as I know, the government's setting up nurseries to plant more carver. So yeah, I think we'll get there.
You talked about the increase in prices. So if you are a consumer from America, how much would you pay for carver?
Carver powder, you're looking anywhere between $35 to $47 a kilo. That's my carver. The 47 is sort of premier carver. It's the carver that's picked from the best carver in the islands. The instant carver, like you've got instant milk, where you just drop a teaspoon in a cup of water and stir it up, or the instant carver's over $180 a kilo. But in saying that, 1 kilo will give you 125 drinks.
Is that instant carver popular?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we cannot keep up the supply. We just cannot keep up. We're so far behind now. But we have ordered some more machinery, equipment, that'll certainly increase it. We've got a food scientist in America working on a new process to increase production. It's a very long process. It takes 8 days. It's a lot of physical work. It's a great industry. It's an interesting industry. Carver's an interesting product.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you have any comments or questions about the program, we'd love to hear from you. The easiest way to contact us is through our email address, which is focus@pcjmedia.com. Or, alternatively, you can also use Facebook. Just do a search for PCJ Radio International. We keep an update of not just this program, but also special programs that we produce and all other programs for PCJ. And you can send us a message there. If you want to re-listen to this program or catch past editions, there's a couple of ways to do it. Either through our website, pcjmedia.com, or you can also download the Stitcher phone app free of charge, and you'll find Focus Asia Pacific there. It's very, very easy. And by the way, we do have a new website for Focus Asia Pacific coming in April. So on behalf of the whole team here at PCJ Radio International, I'm Keith Powell wishing you well. I hope you have a pleasant weekend. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.